It's your Wednesday daily delivery. I am Michael Rand. Glad to be back for another day and a beautiful one out there in Minneapolis. If you are in the area, somewhere nearby, the show is portable. As always, that's the point, or one of the points, aside from bringing you great content. Take me outside today. Listen to this. Take a walk. Go somewhere outside, because these are the days we wait for. I know it wasn't a particularly bad winter, but these are the days we wait for. This is actual spring right now. Get out and enjoy it. Enjoy the show, too, because we got a bunch of good stuff coming up. Jim Suhan, Star Tribune columnist, joins me here in just a little while from the Masters. We will talk a whole bunch of golf. Snuck in a couple Twins things from him, too, although I'll talk Twins here in a minute as well. Wild officially eliminated from the playoffs. We'll get to that in a minute. Some Vikings draft scenarios at the end of the show. I had some best case with Andrew Kramer yesterday. We're going to talk about some worst case at the end of the show today. First, though, what did I miss? All the games we're going to start out with, but I'm going to start with the Timberwolves. Anthony Edwards, 51 points, career high in the win over Washington, kind of rescues them. Naz Reid ejected early in the game. Still no Karl Anthony Towns, although he was cleared for full 5-on-5, everything he can do in practice. So it sounds like his return will be imminent. A side note to the season, an interesting wrinkle as they get ready for the stretch run and the playoffs. Good news for them, obviously, that one of their best players will be healthy and coming back for the playoffs, but how they fit him back in now that they've been on a pretty good run without him remains to be seen. But in this game, it was not just the Anthony Edwards show. Nikhil Alexander-Walker played a big role, a lot of the bench guys too, but Ant had 51, really rescued them from a slow start. They get the win in this game. You know, I think Chris Finch has some interesting things after the game too about how Edwards sometimes goes hunting for these big games, goes hunting for kind of, you know, trying to get his scoring records, things like that. In this case, it came within the flow. It came as they needed him to be this good in this game, because this is not a game they could afford to lose. Washington, one of the worst teams in the NBA. They've got a big game tonight, which we'll get to in a minute here. Denver, kind of the biggest game on their schedule. These are the games they, by and large, lost too many times last season. That's been the difference this year. Them taking these at least seriously enough to win as opposed to messing around too much last year. And Ant was a big part of that, right? Ant last year would kind of mess around, not take these lighter opponents seriously enough. They would find themselves in too competitive a game. And again, that was kind of the case for almost three quarters of this game, 2.5 quarters. They were down, you know, by 5 in the middle of the third quarter. They were down big early, but you never got the feeling they were going to lose this game. And that was kind of a testament to A, where Washington is, where we are in the season, but B, how the Wolves have always found a way, or almost always found a way, to win these games down the stretch this year. Now, big one tonight. Cannot understate what this one means. They are tied in the standings right now with Denver. They are out at Denver. Second game of a back-to-back. A little concerned about how much energy they had to expend just to beat Washington, to be in this game against Denver. You got to feel, though, like the winner of this game, the winner of the Wolves-Denver game, is going to be the champions of the Western Conference. It would give, you know, one team a one-game lead over the other one with two games left. Denver has two pretty easy ones beyond this game against the Wolves. Wolves still have Phoenix on the schedule, but they'd have the tiebreaker against Denver. So you feel like if they can win this game, they will be the West champions. If they lose, they will be either second or third, because Oklahoma City is right there, just a game behind them right now. Wolves have the tiebreaker against OKC as well, but they would be vulnerable in that position. But you know, it's not ultimately, you know, one, two, or three, because if you look at the standings, like we've talked about this year, it's not like you're, you know, gaining, you know, a 5-game advantage over an opponent based on, you know, playing the 6, 7, or 8. Like, all those teams at the bottom are bunched up, and you can say any of those teams would be a big challenge. Maybe the Kings are the one team you would like to find yourself playing in the first round, if possible. They're almost certainly going to be in the play-in right now because of how far they've fallen. They've got some injuries right now. Tough matchup potentially against the Pelicans or Suns, two teams they've lost to twice this year by significant margins. Lakers and Warriors have tons of, you know, veterans, obviously. some of the greats of all time, LeBron, Steph Curry, things like that. So there's not an easy matchup aside from maybe the Kings, and even that wouldn't be easy. There's not like a really favorable matchup down here at the bottom that you're saying, okay, if we can get this, then we get that. So it's not so much important that you get that top seed, but every bit of glory you can get this year, every bit of advantage, you know, which would be if they win tonight, you know, aiming towards that home court advantage in the West, that's only going to help them if and when they can make a run. So a huge one in Denver tonight. We will see if the Wolves can get it done. I'm worried a little bit, like I said, about how much they had to expend just to beat Washington going into a back-to-back, going into the altitude of Denver. But I think at the end of the day, that's not going to matter as much as, you know, just how much they can control the flow, how much they can control what they can control in this game, and that should be a fun one to watch. Now, the flip side of the playoffs are the Wild officially eliminated from postseason contention. It had been all but a, you know, mathematical probability after they, you know, lost a few games, you know, about a week ago. They kind of tumbled down the standings a little bit more. It was kind of just waiting for the final math to come in. That came in with a loss to the Avalanche last night, 5-2. So that is it for the Wild. I think I talked about this last week as they were virtually eliminated from the playoffs. Like, where do they go from here? Feels like a lot of what happened this year, you would like to see them change next year, kind of being stuck in this kind of squishy middle. But it also feels like they're going to have a hard time getting out of that squishy middle because of their roster inflexibility. Again, we keep hammering on this, but they've got these guys with the no-move contracts. They've got one more year next year where they've got the Suter and Parisi buyouts hitting the books hard. Things like that are going to slow them down again next year. It's hard to see them getting out of this gear next year, and it's hard to see them, you know, it's hard to see how they kind of build momentum. But, you know, that's what I'll be watching for next year with the Wild. Not so much, you know, are they going to be a low playoff seed, but can they rebuild some momentum? Can they get themselves going from this spot where they are right now? And again, officially eliminated, not a surprise. More important to me is where they go from here. I went deep on the Twins yesterday, on yesterday's show, just kind of talking about their hitting woes. Then they go out and get three hits, strike out 14 times against Tyler Glasnow for the Dodgers. Looks like the varsity against the junior varsity again. They hit three solo home runs late, but still lose 6-3. They kind of, you know, at least got the bats going a little bit against the Dodgers bullpen. Jeffers, Correa, Kirilloff get it going a little bit, but it still feels like they are just kind of in this space now. They've squandered a lot of the goodwill that they had built up. And again, just 9 games, I know, don't want to overreact, but Jim Suhan and I will talk about this a little bit at the end of our segment here in just a little bit. Just like where they sit right now just doesn't feel good. It feels like when you play the Dodgers, right? Dodgers definitely one of the best teams in baseball. One of the, you know, the biggest resources in baseball right now are one of them. So you know you're at a certain disadvantage. But when you are a contending team, if you are a true contending team, it doesn't feel like a mismatch from the start. It feels like you are able to compete against a team like that. It feels like if you are a World Series contender, if you fancy yourself a team that can go deep in the playoffs, it doesn't feel like an automatic mismatch. It felt like an automatic mismatch these first two games, and it feels like that again going into the series finale today. Now, maybe they win today. Not out of the realm of possibility. Maybe they kind of get that slump reversed. They kind of get everything going, and then they take this on the road and do better. I don't know. I don't know what to think right now, but I don't like what I see, and I don't like the feel of a team that won a playoff series last year that was competitive in the next round. I don't like the feeling that this team right now doesn't seem terribly competitive against a really good team, and certainly weren't that competitive in, you know, again in their at-bats against Tyler Glasnow. So all things aside, even if they want to say Glasnow is the best in baseball, it would beat anybody at this point in the season with the stuff he has, I don't like the feeling that you are saying we can't compete, because that does not strike me as a true contending team. Good to be joined today by Jim Suhan, Star Tribune columnist. He is down in Augusta, Georgia, at the Masters. Jim, how are you?
I'm good, Michael.
Good to hear. Interesting tournament coming up. Starts Thursday, of course, 4 rounds. We'll see who dons the green jacket in the end. Maybe we can start out broadly, Jim, as we kind of think about storylines going in. What do you think are some of the especially on the course, what are some of the biggest things that you are going to be watching as you prepare to cover this tournament and get out there this weekend?
Well, the great thing about golf is there are always like 85 storylines. And so some of the top ones, Scottie Scheffler is by far the best golfer in the world right now. And he's not even putting well. So if he putts well, he's just going to be hard to beat. He's the best player tee to green in the world right now, by far. And it's fascinating to see somebody dominate the world of golf without being able to putt. So, and
Yeah.
here he comes to the trickiest, fastest greens you can putt. He's won here before, but you just don't know. I mean, you can't win the Masters without putting well. So he's kind of a fascinating study in that way. Then you have Jon Rahm, the defending champion, coming back, who made a big deal of saying he was never going to go play for LIV, that he didn't want to join, he wanted the tradition of the PGA Tour. He didn't want to leave. He didn't need that much money. And then boom, he's gone. So 13 LIV golfers are here. Seven of them are former Masters champions. He's the defending champ. So how does he handle that scrutiny? At a press conference yesterday where he's a pretty composed guy off the course, even though there's a little fire on the course, and he handled the questions well, but you don't know what's going on beneath the surface. Does all this stuff bother him? Does it affect the way he plays, or does he somehow rally around that? You have Tiger Woods just can't function physically, and yet
Yeah.
you feel like he has a good round in him. He probably doesn't have a good, could he make, but he's made 23 straight cuts. Last year he made the cut, then couldn't get through the third round physically. So, is he going to win? No. But can he compete just because of his greatness and his knowledge of his course? Can he hang in there for a couple of days? That's going to be interesting Thursday and Friday. And it's golf. There's so many great players. I could give you a list of my 10 favorites, and somebody else not on that list could win it. Will Zalatoris is one of my favorites to watch. This just a tremendous ball striker who has improved his short game, played well in his first start here. Same thing with Degala. There's so many possibilities here. We're also talking about just this the beautiful course, the fact they keep lengthening it, making it harder. They lengthen the 13th hole to make it, so people have to mid irons into that green if they want to go for eagle, which makes it a tougher decision. They backed up the second tee another 10 yards, just trying to make, the par fives a little harder. In summation, I think I'm probably one of the last people from a regional or local newspaper who comes to gets on a plane to come cover this.
Yeah.
We at the Star Tribune, we have continued to cover the Masters, and not that many papers, even of our size, do it anymore.
Yeah. No, that's very true. It's gonna be it should be a great tournament. You talked about Scheffler, obviously, such a dominant player. There's been dominant players obviously throughout the history of golf. There's always, guys that can challenge. There's usually like multiple players who can challenge. What in your mind, if he's not a great putter, how is he so much better than everybody else at ball striking and everything else that he can be the best still in the world?
He has the ability to hit it very high, very far, to work it both ways, to land it softly. And he's a tremendous pitcher. He's a tremendous chipper. He's very smart. He's incredibly competitive and driven. So it's such an advantage. It was the advantage Nicklaus had over his
Yeah.
peers to be able to hit it. And Nicklaus really relied more on a fade. Scotty can hit it both ways, but I think he prefers the fade. And for a right-hander here, to be able to hit a high, soft fade that lands softly on these greens gives you such an advantage. But to be hit it longer, higher, and land it softer than everybody else just gives you an immediate advantage.
That's just so interesting too. Like, you just wonder how like someone's style emerges like that, how they are able to hit shots that other people don't hit. Like, you think about other sports, like, baseball pitcher. Someone has something in their arsenal, and they, everybody else rushes to copy them, and sooner or later, there's some that are slightly better than others, but there's not this huge gap. Like, it's fascinating that he can do so many more things, even as these guys are the best in the world and can train to get even better at these things.
Well, obviously he has a native ability, He's also a pretty big, strong guy. He's not like overly muscled in the arms.
Yeah.
They don't see it. But, he's, you know, compared to most golfers out here, he's kind of a big, strong guy. He's a, he works really hard. He is, and it's all functional strength. It's not for show off strength.
Yeah.
The other thing is that one of the things I love about golf is, you know, with the modern technology and the way you can study your swing and with the biometrics, so many golfers are trying to imitate the theoretical perfect swings. And yet so many of the great players had funky idiosyncratic swings.
Yeah.
Lee Trevino, you know, faced directly left and hit it directly right. You know, Nicklaus just used his legs and drove through the ball. Tiger snapped his left knee shut to generate extra power, which is one of the reasons he didn't last physically, you know, because you can't do that to your knee over and over. And Scottie Scheffler, when he first came out on tour, people were like, oh my God, his feet slide all over the place. How can he possibly be a good golfer? And, you know, that's, and that's a logical thing to say. But the fact that his feet move, I think, releases stress on his back, allows him to really swing through to a full finish without torquing. And if you want to, if you want to be a torque golfer, you're probably going to lack control and you're probably going to hurt yourself. Scottie has this free flowing, long swing that doesn't stress his lower back and just lets him have this full release. And that results in these beautiful high shots.
So who, you mentioned a few golfers initially, who do you like being able to, you know, whose game is kind of peaking at the right time, who's set up particularly well to compete this weekend?
Well, I'll start with the guy who probably isn't, and that's Rory McIlroy.
Yeah.
This course is so in his head. And he's changed everything about his approach. He's playing more. He's practicing less. He showed up later, didn't practice on Monday here. He's trying to change everything to change outcomes. The reality is he only really plays well here since his blow up when he should have won the tournament. He only really plays well here when he's out of contention and can kind of rally without any pressure on him. Okay. He does not play well in the first round here. His game should, I mean, his power certainly matches up well with this course, but, you know, talk about landing it softly. He tends to favor a big hook, and the ball, you know, big hooks can get you in trouble in on a tough golf course. You know, the list of favorites, I mean, I can go on for days. Obviously, Scheffler, if he putts it all. Rahm obviously has the talent. The question is going to be about, you know, is his game in great shape after just competing in 54 events on LIV Tour? Brooks Koepka, you know, was in the lead going the final round last year. So he certainly has the temperament and the ability to do it. But I have more fun kind of going off the obvious favorites.
Right.
And like I said, I think Zalatoris is a really interesting guy to watch. Thigala is a really interesting guy to watch. Xander Schauffele, you know, is kind of one of my favorites here because, you know, he's never won a major. He's so good. You expect him to win one, although we said about a million golfers who haven't gotten it done over the years. But he has the game, and he's probably more than anybody else kind of handled the whole LIV PGA thing well, where he stayed loyal to the PGA, so he doesn't feel guilty about anything. He didn't put himself out there like Rory and some other players and trying to be a spokesman for the PGA, just kind of said, this is where I'm staying. So he's, you know, he's a tremendous player who's a little under the radar, doesn't necessarily have a lot of pressure on him, isn't being talked about, but it certainly has the game to win.
Yeah, no, those are good. Let's talk Tiger for a little bit. Then I want to get into just a tiny bit of the golf impact of the LIV versus PGA stuff. And just, you know, like you said, 13 LIV golfers, seven of them former Master champions, just what that does to the field. But, you know, the Tiger factor is always going to be there. I mean, it's been 5 years even since that surprising run. A lot has happened to Tiger in that time, including the car accident that almost took his leg, probably took his life in that regard. But anytime he's in the field, you think, well, like he's going to draw eyeballs no matter what. So how do you, like you said, he maybe has a great round in him, but like how much attention, I guess, still is on Tiger when he is in a major event like this?
I mean, Tiger was the number one athlete in the world for a while. He was this generation's version of Muhammad Ali. He was the guy who everybody in the world, oh, Tiger Woods. Oh yeah. I mean, he has immediate recognition. He is revered despite his off the course problems he's had over the years. He is revered by this by the entire golf world, especially younger golfers. They look up to him. They realize that he elevated the game of golf, and he made them a lot of money. Okay.
Yeah.
Purses were not that big before Tiger Woods. All of a sudden, purses were huge because there was TV money, and because the PGA is like, well, you know, let's also not only can we afford to pay out bigger purses, but it looks good for our game when people are playing for $2 million instead of $500,000. So they revere his work ethic, his history, his, you know, as he aged, he became much more generous with his fellow players.
Okay.
You know, so they really admire him. So you combine all that, the fact that he's won five Masters, that he won some of them in absolute stunning fashion. Yeah, he's, you know, he's still the biggest deal here. There's no question about it.
Okay. Like you said, the LIV versus PGA thing, it feels like it's to me, at least, it's faded a little bit, but maybe that's not great for either tour, right? Like the LIV is kind of faded just because nobody's really watching it. The PGA is losing, you know, losing some eyeballs and some viewers because it's like you wrote the other day, it's a lot of the big names are gone. So this, you know, the split, aside from the pocketbooks of some of the golfers who went to LIV, hasn't really done a lot of anybody any favors. Now you're bringing a lot of these golfers back together again, and I don't imagine there's a whole, I can't imagine the tension will play out so much on the golf course, but it's just the fact that we have more of a full field right now, kind of a reminder of what golf can be when everybody's playing together. And just, you know, just the fact that these two tours kind of are where they are, and there's this talk of some reconciliation, things like that. How do you think that all of that kind of swirl plays into the weekend?
Well, the PGA Tour players are just kind of over all of it.
Yeah.
You know, these they can't take any kind of moral high ground now because the PGA Tour backstabbed them. PGA Tour said, "Hey, you got to stay with us. We're the traditional tour. We're going to fight for what we have. We're going to, you know, we're going to look down on the LIV golfers."
Right.
And then the tour said, "Oh, but unless they can offer us a lot of money, then we'll just do it. We'll negotiate a deal with them." The deal isn't done yet, and we don't know if or when it's ever going to get done. But the PGA Tour no longer has any high ground. They're just in business. Like most of these golfers,
right?
But really, the split has diminished the entire game of golf. LIV players look selfish and greedy, and nobody watches them. And the PGA Tour now, you see, you know, I know a lot of golf writers are like, "Oh, look at all these great young players who are winning tournaments." Well, they're winning. They might have won anyway, but they also might have finished fourth because you might have had Rahm and you know, Dustin Johnson and Brooks Koepka ahead of them.
Yes.
If those guys had been in the field. It makes the PGA Tour look diminished because they acted like they were seizing the high ground when they really weren't. And then it kind of, you know, messed over some PGA players like Rory, who took a big emotional, you know, what he thought was a moral stand, only to find out the PGA Tour wasn't even back in his play. So the flip side of that is the golf world reunited here. And you know, settlement between the two sides is going to be so important because if they continue to go down this road where LIV players aren't on the PGA Tour, they can't qualify for majors, and you know, unless they win majors, because they're not going to be earning you know, points toward major invitations either way. I mean, so you know, this is, some of these players are running out of exemption time, so that makes this competition even a little heightened than usual.
Yep. A couple more things, Jim. Anything weather-wise of note, or just a course-wise? You mentioned a couple of the things that have changed. Like, does anything favor anybody in particular? Are we looking through for smooth forecasts? What are we looking at from that standpoint?
Might have some weather on Wednesday, on Thursday. So the first round might be messy. Who knows if they get all their holes in on Thursday? We'll see. The Masters, you know, they got some connections with people upstairs. They will find a way to finish the tournament on Sunday night in prime time on CBS. That's what they, you know, that's it always happens. So I'm not worried about the tournament getting in, but it might get off to a little bit of a slow start. Course is spectacular as always. Absolutely gorgeous here. The fact that they have had a little rain means it's as lush as it can possibly be. Maybe rain on Thursday softens the course up enough that Scheffler has an even greater advantage. And, you know, they, again, Not no major core changes this year. Last year they backed up the 13th tee a long way to make it harder to just, you know, they've got tired of people hitting nine irons and for the second shot into the green. So it's going to be more like four or five irons in a lot of cases now, which makes it a little more challenging. The second hole, the par five, they backed up the tee about 10 yards just to make it a little more challenging. I'm not sure those things. The 13th hole will be the one to watch because last year, people were just getting used to it. This year, we'll see if anybody adopts any new strategies.
Royal Credit Union Smart Checking Accounts offer no monthly fees and no minimum balance. Enjoy financial freedom when you open your Royal Credit Union Smart Checking Account online at rcu.org/gochecking. Insured by NCUA.
Last thing, one of the side benefits for you, Jim, is being in Augusta. You don't have to be at Target Field right now where there's not a lot of great baseball being played. Maybe indulge me with a little one minute of Twins talk. You know, they're 3-6 again, 9 games into the season. If they have a 3-6 stretch during the middle of a season, people are grumpy, but they're not up in arms. Seems like people are pretty upset. Fans are upset. They're not playing well. What's your take on this start and this team in general? Because you've covered a lot of ball over the years, obviously.
Well, I don't look at standings or stats early in the year, but I do think you have to use your eyes. And what we're seeing is terrible at bats, And I know they miss Royce Lewis, and I know Royce Lewis is not only their best player, their best hitter, and their most adaptable hitter, the guy who changes his approach to fit the situation. But they're getting nothing out of second. Right. And listen, I wrote a piece going into the season saying, the second half of last year, they were one of the best offensive teams in baseball. They have the potential to do that for a full season this year if guys like Julian and Wallner continue to do what they did last year. Julian's been terrible. Wallner has been even worse. Julian is taking way too many pitches. He's taking called third strikes with runners in scoring position. Listen, strikeouts aren't always bad, but they're terrible with runners in scoring position, where if you just touch the ball, you have a chance of scoring a run. And they're taking terrible at bats with runners in scoring position. Wallner is into the plate. Pitchers have figured out how to get him out, and he's not adjusting. Tons of talent there, but he can't just keep doing the same thing over and over. He's diving into pitches. They're pitching him inside. He can't get his arms around. He's going to have to learn how to adapt. Last year, Kepler turned his season around when he stopped diving at the plate and leveled out his stride. He needs to make, but I think Wallner's bit so bad right now, he's probably going to have to go to AAA to figure it out. And they're getting nothing out of third base, which, you know, is going to, third base was going to be a major strength for this team with Royce Lewis there. Now it's a major weakness. So those three offensive positions, are getting nothing out of them. And the overall team approach with runner scoring position has been embarrassingly bad.
Yeah. Other than that, it's been great, as Mike Zimmer might say. It's just 9 games, so we'll see. But you're right. I think the eye test is the more important thing than anything right now. And if you look at it right now, it's not great. And one thing, you know, I've mentioned is, it seems like, again, it's just 9 games, but they've squandered, at least early, at least some of the goodwill they built up with that playoff run. Again, it's so early. Like, they go on a winning streak right now. People forget about this, and the loudest voices tend to be the biggest critics, things like that. But you couldn't help but wonder going into the year and now feel it a little bit again that if they were going to build on that, a good start and people feeling good about this team would be important, and that's not happening right now.
I also think that Minnesotans are not predisposed to being baseball fans. They every loss is torture. Anything that goes wrong, they just, oh my God, it's Minnesota sports. It's not. I mean, I care about the hitting approach. I think that is vital. I care about the health of their pitchers. I worry about, everybody should worry about the depth of their starting pitching. Those are legitimate concerns. Being 3-6 is not a big deal. Yep. If you play well the rest of the year, nobody will remember this. But the hitting approach is a major problem that needs to be solved. And last year, it felt like it got solved by Royce Lewis coming up and by Julian coming up and being great right away and Wallner coming up being great right away. So Lewis being missing and the other two guys not performing is the major concern facing this team right now.
Great points. All of those great stuff on the Masters. Jim, we'll talk again in a couple days. Enjoy the coverage down there. Follow Jim's coverage in Star Tribune, StarTribune.com. And Jim, we'll talk soon.
Great. Thank you, Michael.
Great stuff from Jim. Appreciate him hopping on. I'm going to have him on one more time Friday from the Masters, coming off of the first round Thursday. We'll talk quickly on Friday just about what has transpired and set up the weekend. So appreciate Jim, and listen for more of that on Friday's show. Let us finish now with the cooler. Like I mentioned at the jump, we talked yesterday with Andrew Kramer, talked through a lot of the best case scenarios for the Vikings, right? Like what, as they try to get a quarterback in the draft this year, what are some of the best case scenarios? And he brought up the idea of, you know, what if a quarterback starts to fall on the board? As unlikely as that might be, what if Drake May starts to slide? What if JJ McCarthy starts to slide? Things like that. Makes it easier to get them. Maybe you can even wait all the way to 11 if you've got clear signals you can do that. Or maybe a trade up becomes easier if you don't have to invest quite as much. That is, you know, one of the best case scenarios, aside from, you know, another one being, hey, maybe what you want is, you know, to get up to 3 in New England is giving you a fair price to get up to number 3 and get your guy Drake May. Or maybe you want Bo Nix, or maybe you want Michael Penix, and you're just kind of playing it coy right now, and you can wait until, you know, 11 or even 23 and not have to move up in the draft. You're giving yourself flexibility with that extra first round pick. Those are some of the best case scenarios. We don't exactly know what their mindset is, but we can kind of guess at what the best case scenarios would be if they have a certain mindset. Now today, let's talk about some of the worst case scenarios. First worst case scenario to me is, these two are tied. And this is the interesting thing, because they're kind of tied together, but they are tied at the top for me in terms of worst case scenarios. The first is that the price to move up is so high for a quarterback that isn't worth it, that it basically keeps you from doing anything else, or it feels like you are mortgaging your future. You're paying far in excess. And again, Andrew Kramer would argue, and I think to a good degree, that if you get it right, nobody will remember that you overpaid. And I get that, but I don't want them getting into the scenario where, like Mel Kiper Jr. again, mock draft today, I've seen this in other mock drafts, where to move up to 5 to get JJ McCarthy, you've got to give up 11, 23, and next year's number one pick, next year's first round pick. That just feels like so much, too much. It feels like you're going so far because everybody knows you are desperate for a quarterback. You've boxed yourself into this corner where everybody knows you need a quarterback. That, to me, feels like a nightmare scenario. But the other flip side of the worst case scenarios is that you get shut out of the guy you really want, or one of the guys you really want, that you're not willing to pay it. So it's like both of those things probably won't happen, right? You can't both overpay and get shut out. I can't tell which will be worse. Maybe the worst is that you don't get your guy, so you do have to overpay, right? Like, they're in a position where they've absolutely decided that they need a quarterback, so getting shut out of a quarterback you really want probably is the worst case scenario, because then you're just kind of stuck in a year where you're grinding your gears, you're trying to get better in other spots. Maybe it works out for you. Maybe Sam Darnold has a functional, serviceable year, things like that. But you haven't really advanced your master plan at quarterback. You've stalled out for a year, and you don't really know where you're going beyond that. You're going to have to try to redo this again in 2025, or switch to plan C or plan D. So that's the other worst case scenario, that you don't get a quarterback at all, or you don't get a guy that you think is a franchise caliber quarterback. Now, the third worst case scenario to me is that things start to break a certain way and they look like they're going good, and the Vikings overcomplicate it. They try to make a trade up that gets them to a certain spot, or try to make a trade down because they think they can do this or that, and then it backfires. They've tried to move around the board all sorts of times all throughout the years. Kwesi Adofo-Mensah likes to make trades. My one worst case scenario for me, like I said, is that he overcomplicates it, that he thinks he can get more value in a certain way, and then that ends up backfiring and they don't end up getting what they really want. So those are some ways I can see this thing going sideways on draft night in a couple weeks. Like I said, there could be a best case scenario, worst case scenario. The most likely scenario is that it's somewhere in the middle, right? That they maybe have to overpay a little bit to get the quarterback they want, but they get him in the end. And like Andrew Kramer says, in the end, nobody really cares if you overpay if you get it right, but everybody will remember if you miss on the quarterback either way, because people will lose their jobs. That will do it for me today. Randy Johnson expected to join me on Thursday show to talk Frozen Four, Gophers men's hockey. A lot of news there, even though they're not in the Frozen Four, so plenty to look forward to. And I'll definitely go deep on Wolves versus Nuggets on Thursday show as well. Until then, I am Michael Rand, back at it again on Thursday.